everyone. Welcome to News and Brew Sports Biz, our podcast series that advocates for the financial voices in college athletics and features new developments impacting the business. I'm Katie Davis.
And I'm Ken Kurtzel. It's been a few months since we released our last podcast episode, but we're starting back today with the hot topic of NIL. Joining us today is Jim Booz, the newest member of the James Moore Collegiate Athletic Advisory Team. Jim comes to us with nearly three decades of experience in collegiate athletics programming and management, bringing us strategic advice regarding NIL concerns and other intricate NCAA matters. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks, Katie. Happy to be here and happy to join the team.
I'm really happy to, and couldn't have joined us at a more perfect time, given everything that's happened right now in NIL and athlete employment universe. I'm just going to go ahead and preface that we're recording this on March 5th, 2024. So, things are changing by the day, the hour. So there might be new things happening between now and when you listen to this. So just keep that in mind when you're listening. But, you know, with things starting to change that are going to impact in-house operations, collegiate athletic departments will have to adjust infrastructure, policies, personnel assignments, and more. And Jim, your experience on the athletic side of navigating these concerns gives our clients a huge advantage when facing the same challenges. I'm just really excited to pick your brain about the NIL changes and what schools should be thinking about. But first, to kick off, I want to talk about the Tennessee and Virginia versus NCAA cases and the NCAA's subsequent communication.
Yeah, you know, that Tennessee and Virginia versus NCAA case seems to be born out of Tennessee allegedly violating some NCAA rules regarding recruiting in a prospect surrounding NIL. And obviously through that, the general counsels, or I'm sorry, no, it's not the general counsel, the attorney generals from each state decided to bring a case against the NCAA there to allege that there was a restriction of trade essentially in the recruiting process. And as such, one of the courts in the eastern part of Tennessee did ultimately affirm that the NCAA was in violation of the law at the time. And since then, the NCAA has decided and notified all of the institutions that they're not going to either initiate or continue any current NIL allegations regarding the recruiting circumstances of NIL. So that's been a big transition for many of the departments. And one of the big things that is going to really test is here in just a few weeks, the transfer portal for men's basketball. Women's basketball opens. And so now, right at this point, the collectives and other third parties are permitted to engage with prospective student athletes and offer NIL deals to come to their institutions.
That's obviously, you know, just going to be a massive, massive change to know that. I mean, it clearly was probably going on in many cases already, but then now to just have it really out in the public and, you know, no holds barred, so to speak, at this point and out in the light is going to be a big change, obviously, moving forward. Similarly, you know, kind of in this same vein, you know, we've got what many say is the inevitability that college athletes will eventually be considered employees. We've had the two NLRB cases at Dartmouth and USC, which Katie already referenced. Just, you know, the fact that the day that we're recording this on, you know, the union vote occurred at Dartmouth for the men's basketball program. So those are hot in the headlines right now. What are some things that schools need to be thinking about as we march towards, you know, what seems to be an inevitable move towards athlete employment?
Yeah, you know, one of the things, and I do think it's inevitable that that day is coming. You know, Dartmouth has already appealed that decision, which is, you know, no surprise to those of us that have been, you know, paying close attention to it. So even though the men's basketball team did vote in favor of that, I think it was 13-2, the university has appealed that, and is going to end up back in the courts, and could possibly end up to this with the Supreme Court in some time. So still yet to be determined how that's actually going to play out. But regardless, it is a move, a significant move in that direction of athletes being considered employees. And as such, I think it's incumbent upon athletic departments and the institutions, not only just the athletic department, but the entire institution, recognizing that there is going to be a change in this industry, if you will, and a change in terms of how are we going to attract and retain talent. Are we going to do that the same way in which we've done it before, whether it's just the general recruiting of young people to come to an institution, or is there going to be a draft model? Is there going to be some sort of hybrid, type thing? So that's just one way in which I think departments have to begin to think about how are they going to attract and retain employees in this new wave of college athletics.
Yeah, and something that Ken actually asked me yesterday when we were talking about what athlete employment could look like, and it's like, well, of course we don't know, we're not attorneys, but can you restrict athlete employment to only 4 years, or could they be an 8-year student or something and still be participating? So even just things like that of trying to understand what that's going to look like is going to be really interesting.
One of the sorry to interrupt,
No,
Katie.
go ahead.
No,
One
it's good.
of the things to think about in that vein is, do the employees even have to be students at your institution in order to represent your institution to compete, right? And so there's that thought as well, is will we require those individuals who are now employees of the institution to have to go to school? Is one thing that I've heard a number of institutions talk about.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how this evolves. And and then of course, and again, this is outside of my realm, but gender equity when it comes to that, and if it's not under Title IX, I mean, I think Title VII is for employment. So there's going to be some kind of regulation around that as well that just keep an eye on for sure.
There's no question. And I think a lot of places are unsure of what the implications are, right? And I, from a Title IX perspective, and I would hope that opportunities continue to be made available for, particularly for women in college athletics. The finances aren't going to bear that out. We already know that. Most departments, have a hard time financially supporting enough programs to meet the Title IX requirements. But I would hate to see that any of those opportunities go away because of all this.
Oh, me too. And we hear a lot of, there's going to have to be, likely sports cut if, the funding just keeps coming through more and more, and their value is up. I mean, something's got to give. So with, you can stop future facilities projects or, future escalations of coaching compensation, but you're already in con under contract or having debt service on what you've already done, and that's still requiring money to go out the door. So, I think in many ways they're going to have to look at how do they reduce sports. And I think I've heard some ask the question of, will the NCAA change their requirements for the number of sports you sponsor to remain in the division that you're in? And if so, I imagine you're going to see a lot of for Title IX reasons, keeping women's sports as much as you can, and cutting back more and more on the men's sports, which is also a shame.
No question.
So what are the top like 5 to 10 things that athletic departments need to do like now to prepare for reality?
So I think first and foremost, one, just we athletic departments need to acknowledge that reality is changing. We don't know what it's going to look like yet, but it is not going to look like it did yesterday, and it certainly doesn't look like what it did last year. and won't. So just like really just acknowledging first that this is changing, this is coming, and then also communicate, I think, really well with particularly with their head coaches and their student athletes about these changes coming, I think are two things that really can't be underscored enough is just to communicate with them. Lack of communication, lack of information erodes trust. And in a shifting environment where it's already challenging for athletic departments and student athletes, I think just that communication is really important. But more practically, I think really need to begin to involve, and if you haven't already, begin to involve or develop really close relationships with your general counsel, with the university CFO, your VPs for human resources and things of that nature, which are typically, again, not really closely connected to athletic departments on campus. Athletic departments on campuses typically insulate themselves and have some of those units just within their department. And this change is so significant. I think it would be a mistake to insulate your department and try to make those decisions just within your department. I think it's really incumbent upon departments to engage their university leadership in these conversations, and then others as well. I mean, there are significant stakeholders at every institution that are going to have opinions on this, and being again, open and honest and transparent with those individuals, but also at the same time, help making sure that they realize that while they do have influence, they're probably not going to be the decision makers in this process. This is no longer, and to some degree, up to what a university or a department thinks they should do with their employees. It's going to be required by law. And that's just a different mind shift within the industry that has to come to the realization. One question too is, I think athletic departments and universities need to ask themselves is, are we going to do this? Right? Do we want to be in this model, or do we want to be in a different model, whatever that might look like, where we're not going to pay athletes, and then decide, how do we do it? Right? Are we going to be in this part of the college athletics landscape? And then if we are, how do we do it? And how do we do it? Some of the questions are simple as this. How do we determine the value of a particular player? Right? Who is thinking about that today in your department, about when we can pay athletes, whether it's for their performance or for their NIL rights? How do we determine that value for that particular person? And then how does that impact team dynamics across the board? So how do you do it? But also, who is going to do that, right? Is that going to be your head coach? Is it going to be your CFO? Is it going to be somebody that you don't even have on your staff yet that may have experience in determining player evaluation scenarios for professional athletes, and then bring that model into college athletics? So those, are a couple of things. The return on your investment, right? If we're now paying these individuals, how do we determine the return on that investment, and who's going to communicate those types of things to the players as those decisions get made? Those are just some practical questions that I think athletic directors, athletic administrators, university leadership need to be asking themselves. And then again, identifying who within your ecosystem is going to be your expert or team of experts as it relates to labor law, to tax, to payroll, to HR in this new landscape.
Yeah, the return on investment is interesting because it for whatever reason it made me think of like personnel evaluations. And when you
Right,
go through your
right.
semi-annual reviews or whatever, and
Yeah.
just seeing what that look, what does that look like for an athlete,
Yeah.
and how do you communicate? You showed up late, or you were
Right.
disrespectful, whatever,
Right.
or you're being evaluated on things that aren't necessarily sports performance, but are more, behavioral or whatever the case, and just being able to put that into writing of, here's your job description, and
Yeah.
then this is what we're going to be evaluating you on, and your compensation may be impacted based on how you perform in this type of evaluation, not just your skills on the field.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a hardcore business element to this. Obviously, that exists in professional sports, but these are young men and women who arguably 25% of every athlete on one's campus is entering their first year in college, right? That means they're 17, 18 years old and now going into conversations into an environment like this that they will not be prepared for. And so another question is, who's going to represent them in the transition, right? What are they going to look to look for guidance in education and support in that transition?
And something, Jim, that you said that struck me that I really agreed with was, that concept of having good relationships with your general counsel, with your HR, those different areas on campus. I mean, one thing we've observed over the years of working with many, many different schools is that, unfortunately, many times, like you said, athletics is somewhat of a silo, and there's not that deep relationship where they're getting the support they need from the HR department. So, like, thinking about, okay, if these hundreds of student athletes are becoming employees, that's changing the dynamic in the HR side dramatically, of course, and with everything that's needed. And I don't, my guess is most schools just aren't really prepared for that influx of additional HR responsibilities within athletics, that isn't there right now.
I completely agree. I think most HR professionals on college campuses right now probably aren't even aware of this. They have such a broad and large responsibility of the current faculty and staff members on their campuses, and so they're probably not tracking on this unless their athletic administration has been really proactive in this sense. And not that I doubt that's the case. I just know that athletic directors and others have so much on their plate right now trying to navigate this. There probably just isn't enough time in the day to do all of it. And so, how are the departments going to try to balance all of this? So navigating the landscape to decide what's going to happen and how are we going to do it, while then also literally overnight having to flip a switch from one model to the next. And we know that there are many departments that are so competitive, right? They want to have their system in place on day one so that they can either develop or maintain a competitive advantage so that they don't lose any ground. And that's where I think those departments that are going to be positioned well, so that when this does flip, that they can maintain their competitive advantage, they'll be best situated.
Yeah, and certainly there's that old expression, the advantage of a first mover, of kind
That's
of
right.
being at the forefront of something new, and that's certainly something we're going to see in collegiate athletics with. It's really hard to overstate the size of these changes that are coming, and are coming faster than I think everybody thought, hey, this will get here eventually. We'll get to athlete revenue sharing and things like that, but the speed at which it's coming is, I think, catching really all of us, ourselves included, a little bit surprised.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that the athlete employment thing, they'll take this to the Supreme, all the way up to the Supreme Court. It's going to be a while
Yeah.
before it truly goes into effect, but you've got to start preparing for it, or at least preparing for the unionizations and things like that that are currently happening. But I mean, NIL is going to exist regardless, and
Correct.
so I think the other thing, what we're seeing and questions that we're hearing are around, who does what as things shift with NIL and it comes in-house, and do the collectives still matter? Do they still exist? And I've heard different takes on that, as well as, we're seeing, announcements that schools are, investigating creating their own 501c3 entities to manage this, or I mean, even before this, more and more schools have been looking to create a separate entity as opposed to operating within the university. And it's, some schools have been doing it for, almost 100 years even. But, just talking through the different models of what that looks like, because you could go all in, you could be a hybrid, you could choose not to do that. And I think there are ways to be successful doing that, and even figuring out how to leverage your collective or your collective for helping you with certain functions that are either, things that just are going to take too many resources from your department, or making certain decisions that would currently, jeopardize your department from, a legal perspective or Title IX or anything like that. And so understanding, who does what and, how they can fit, but still having more control and transparency and things like that. So I think that's going to be, interesting strategies that are going to take place, as well as just, evaluating how are we going to structure. And of course, the other questions that I hear a lot of, how can anyone in good conscience, I mean, it's the same argument we've heard with these 501c3 collectives of how can people donate to these collectives and write them off as a tax deductible donation. And really, I think in my mind, there's a slight difference of, because these 501c3s already exist. If they're like a booster club or athletics foundation or an athletic association, they have a purpose and a mission, and they operate in that manner. And yeah, that there are some tax laws about, certain contributions, perceived contributions and things like that, that athletic departments have had to navigate and get innovative to be able to, help their boosters maximize their contributions. And in my mind, they're already giving to a pot of money where some of that money goes to coaching compensation. So in my mind, it wouldn't be much different if it's going to athlete compensation as an employee. Where it gets muddy is this NIL stuff, and when it's used for recruiting, and when they're clearly operating in a different fashion from what their mission says. But I mean, if their mission is to support athletics and they're getting money to support operations, and then, but they're also having to make payments. I mean, in my mind, it doesn't necessarily create as gray of an area, but there is still a lot of concern and questions on that. And at some point, I'm sure the IRS will come out with some special rules for that, and we just have to wait for that. But that's definitely front of mind on my side as well.
I agree. I think it was maybe last May when the IRS, drafted and sent out the first memo. And it doesn't, we talked a lot about this last, 6 to 8 weeks is, once we get through this tax cycle again, I suspect the IRS is going to have additional information, right? And there'll be additional regulations either proposed or implemented with this additional information. And so, last year it was after tax season when the IRS came out with some information. I suspect, we're probably weeks away from hearing a little bit more from them about what's going on in the collective space. So, Ken, to your point earlier about, things continuing to change and evolve, there's the tax implications. The NCAA is about to issue some additional proposals as it relates to the NIL space and institutional involvement, here in the next 3 to 6 weeks or so, and those will be voted on and sometime this summer. And then we have the additional court cases that are scheduled to be heard in early 2025. And a lot of the experts there are betting that those are going to be settled. And so if they're settled, they're going to be settled in this calendar year as well. So there's a lot to remain in 2024, where a lot of things are going to change outside of just the employment space. Katie, you're right. With the NLRB decision, and the true employment conversation still probably a couple of years away, it doesn't mean that all these other things aren't going to happen. And enforce a little bit more chaos in the landscape. There's still a lot on left in 2024 that's going to happen.
Oh, absolutely. And again, I think of this, and I guess I want to believe, or I do believe, that college athletics will survive. That it will look different, but it'll survive. And kind of keeping a calmness to kind of working through the storm as we evolve to a new model is gonna be key. And the you know as you mentioned already, the schools that best prepare themselves seem like they're going to be in a position to thrive, under the new model, as well. So, trying to keep that in mind and not let it all overwhelm you.
Yeah, slow and steady wins the race, right? And yeah, there's a time where you have to go. When the horn sounds, it's time to go, but you gotta do all the practice and the preparation ahead of time for that race so that when it does go, you're ready. And for those that are engaged in this conceptually right now and not putting their heads in the sand and trying to tackle it, one thing at a time, I think is the wise move for departments.
Well, one thing I know is that I think, all of this makes me think it definitely is appropriate to have time for a good craft beer or wine or other beverage of your choice, and kind of embrace that other part of our podcast name, News and Brews.
Well, nice segue.
That Katie and I always enjoy a good brew when we're out on the road visiting our clients and all of that. So, as our newest member, Jim, we want to start with you with what brew of choice have you been enjoying lately?
That's a great question. In Charlottesville, there are a lot of breweries and also a lot of wineries. There's a ton of vineyards up here as well. And one of my favorite places is a place called Pro Renata, and it's Latin for "as the needed rises." And so one of my go-tos there is a beverage, a beer called Tapped Out. It's a little Czech Pilsner that is certainly one of my favorite go-tos.
That sounds awesome. And Katie, how
It,
about
well,
you?
it sounds like I need to go to Charlottesville sometime soon.
Definitely, yeah.
Come on.
So I have not, well, and I've been talking about wine a lot, I think probably over the last 6 months or so, as opposed to beer. I've kind of shifted in that, and I'm going to be traveling next week to Spain, and I don't know a lot about Spanish wine, so I'm excited to learn about it. So I'm just going to go ahead and say some kind of Spanish wine, probably Tempranillo or something like that. And I'm excited to, I'm doing a wine tasting there. So hopefully next month I will be talking even more about Spanish wine and people will probably be like, get back to the IPAs. But yeah, so that's what I'm looking forward to.
Well, that's great. And I'm going to round it out. Actually, I'm going to switch off. I almost always share about an IPA because it's my favorite style of beer. But we just got back. We were in Oxford, Mississippi last week for work. And I have to have a shout out to really what's one of my favorite coffee shops of any place that we visit. It's Heartbreak Coffee in Oxford, right on the near the square there. In the old part of town, and they just have great coffee, great atmosphere, and very much enjoyed that while I was there. But trust me, I am still drinking IPAs at home as well, so
Yeah,
and enjoying that.
they do have good coffee. And I will say, aside from Gainesville, which is my home, and I will always have a favorite, my favorite other favorite SEC town, I think, is Oxford, because it's quaint but cute and there's a lot going on. And it's not a sleepy town. So shout out to
It's a good
Oxford for
time.
sure. Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. This has been great. Really enjoyed it.
And thanks to all our listeners for tuning in. Cheers.
Cheers.
To learn more about the James Warren Company Collegiate Athletics and Higher Education segments, go to jmco.com. And don't forget to sign up for Insights to get our latest industry updates, news, and events delivered straight to your inbox. You can also follow us on Twitter at @JMCOHigherEd and on LinkedIn for the latest news as the landscape of collegiate athletics and higher education is continually evolving.